It was a disaster. The useless exercise had taken all the primetime television hours when nearly 18 million households were watching the convention. The intended media events, Senator Edward Kennedy's speech nominating McGovern and the nominee's own acceptance speech, were pushed back into the wee hours of the morning. Senator Kennedy was a champ and gave a rousing speech. McGovern's was good, too. He called on America to come home from deception in high places, from the waste of idle hands, from prejudice. Come home to the affirmation that we have a dream, to the conviction that we can move our country forward, to the belief that we can seek a newer world. The problem was that McGovern began to talk at 2:48 a.m., or prime time in Samoa, as the humorous Mark Shields quipped. He had lost 80% of his television audience. As if that weren't enough, it soon became public that Eagleton had had treatment, including electric shock therapy, for depression. Unfortunately, back then, there was still a great deal of ignorance about the nature and range of mental health problems, as well as the fact that previous presidents, including Lincoln and Wilson, had suffered from periodic depression. The idea that Senator Eagleton would be next in line to be president if McGovern were elected was unsettling to many people, even more so because Eagleton hadn't told McGovern about it. If McGovern had known and picked him anyway, perhaps we could have made real progress in the public's understanding of mental health. But the way it came out raised questions not only about McGovern's judgment, but also about his competence as well. Our vaunted campaign operation hadn't even vetted Eagleton's selection with Missouri's Democratic Governor Warren Hearns, who knew about the mental health issue. Within a week after the Miami convention, we were even in worse shape than when the Democrats had exited Chicago 4 years earlier, looking both too liberal and too inept. After the Eagleton story came out, McGovern first said he stood by his running mate 1,000%. A few days later, under withering and unrelenting pressure from his own supporters, he dropped him. Then it took until the second week of August to get a replacement. Sergeant Shriver, President Kennedy's brother-in-law, said yes, after Ted Kennedy, Senator Abe Ribicoff of Connecticut, Governor Reuben Askew of Florida, Hubert Humphrey, and Senator Ed Muskie all declined to join the ticket. I was convinced that most Americans would vote for a peace candidate who was progressive, but not too liberal. And before Miami, I thought we could sell McGovern. Now we were back to square one. After the convention, I went to Washington to see Hillary, so exhausted I slept more than 24 hours straight. A few days later, I packed up to go to Texas to help coordinate the general election campaign there. I knew it was going to be tough when I flew from Washington to Arkansas to pick up a car. I sat next to a young man from Jackson, Mississippi, who asked me what I was doing. When I told him, he almost shouted, "You're the only white person I've ever met for McGovern." Later, when I was home watching John Dean testify about the misdeeds of the Nixon White House before Senator Sam Ervin's Watergate committee, the phone rang. It was the young man whom I'd met on the airplane. He said, "I just called so you could say I told you so." I never heard from him again, but I appreciated the call. It was amazing how far public opinion moved in just 2 years as Watergate unfolded. In the summer of 1972, however, going to Texas was a fool's errand, although it was a fascinating one. Starting with John Kennedy in 1960, Democratic presidential campaigns often assigned out-of-staters to oversee important state campaigns on the theory that they could bring competing factions together and make sure all decisions put the candidates' interests, not parochial concerns, first. Whatever the theory, in practice, outsiders could inspire resentment on all sides, especially for a campaign as troubled as McGovern's, in an environment as fractured and contentious as Texas. The campaign decided to send two of us to Texas, me and Taylor Branch, whom, as I've said, I'd first met on Martha's Vineyard in 1969. As an insurance policy, the campaign named a successful young Houston lawyer, Julius Glickman, to be the third member of our triumvirate. Since Taylor and I were both Southerners and not averse to cooperating, I thought we might be able to make it work in Texas. We set up a headquarters on West 6th Street in Austin, not far from the state capital, and shared an apartment on a hill just across the Colorado River. Taylor ran the headquarters operation and controlled the budget. We didn't have much money, so it was fortunate that he was tight-fisted, and better than I was at saying no to people. I worked with the county organizations, and Julius lined up what support he could get from prominent Texans he knew, and we had a great staff of enthusiastic young people. Three of them became especially close friends of Hillary's and mine. Gary Mauro, who became Texas Land Commissioner and took a leading role in my presidential campaign, and Roy Spence and Judy Tribulsi, who founded an advertising agency that became the largest in America outside New York City. Gary, Roy, and Judy would support me and Hillary in all our campaigns. The Texan who had by far the greatest impact on my career was Betsy Wright, a doctor's daughter from the small West Texas town of Alpine. She was just a couple of years older than I was, but much more experienced in grassroots politics, having worked for the State Democratic Party and Common Cause. She was brilliant, intense, loyal, and conscientious almost to a fault. And she was the only person I had ever met who was more fascinated by and consumed with politics than I was. Unlike some of our more inexperienced colleagues, she knew we were getting the daylights beaten out of us, but she worked 18-hour days anyway. After I was defeated for governor in 1980, Hillary asked Betsy to come to Little Rock to help organize my files for a comeback. She did, and she stayed to run my successful campaign in 1982. Later, Betsy served as chief of staff in the governor's office. In 1992, she played a pivotal role in the presidential campaign, defending me and my record from the endless barrage of personal and political attacks with a skill and strength no one else could have mustered and maintained. Without Betsy Wright, I could not have become president. After I had been in Texas a few weeks, Hillary joined me and the campaign, having been hired by Ann Wexler to do voter registration for the Democratic Party. She got on well with the rest of the staff and brightened even my toughest days. The Texas campaign got off to a rocky start, mostly because of the Eagleton disaster, but also because a lot of the local Democrats didn't want to be identified with McGovern. Senator Lloyd Benson, who had defeated the fiery liberal Senator Ralph Yarber 2 years earlier, declined to be the campaign chairman. The gubernatorial nominee, Dolph Briscoe, a South Texas rancher who years later became a friend and supporter of mine, didn't even want to appear in public with our candidate. Former Governor John Connally, who had been riding in the car with President Kennedy when he was killed 9 years earlier and had been a close ally of President Johnson, was leading a group called Democrats for Nixon. Still, Texas was too big to write off, and Humphrey had carried it 4 years earlier, though by only 38,000 votes. Finally, two elected state officials agreed to co-chair the campaign, Agriculture Commissioner John White and Land Commissioner Bob Armstrong. White, an old-fashioned Texas Democrat, knew we couldn't win, but wanted the Democratic ticket to make the best showing possible in Texas. John later became chairman of the Democratic National Committee. Bob Armstrong was an ardent environmentalist who loved to play guitar and hang out with us at Schultz's Beer Garden, the local bowling alley, or the Armadillo Music Hall, where he took Hillary and me to see Jerry Jeff Walker and Willie Nelson. I thought things were looking up in late August when Senator McGovern and Sergeant Shriver were slated to come to Texas to see President Johnson. Shriver was a likable man with a buoyant personality who brought energy and gravitas to the ticket. He had been a founder of the Legal Services Corporation, which provides legal assistance to the poor, President Kennedy's first director of the Peace Corps, and President Johnson's first director of the War on Poverty. McGovern and Shriver's meeting with President Johnson went reasonably well, but delivered few political benefits because Johnson insisted there be no press and because he had already issued a lukewarm endorsement of McGovern to a local newspaper a few days before they met. The main thing I got out of it was an autographed picture of the president, which he had signed when Taylor had gone out to the LBJ ranch a few days before the meeting to finalize the arrangements. Probably because we were pro-civil rights Southerners, Taylor and I liked Johnson more than most of our McGovern co-workers did. After the meeting, McGovern went back to his hotel suite in Austin to meet with some of his main supporters and staff people. There were a lot of complaints about the disarray in the campaign. It certainly was disorganized. Taylor and I hadn't been there long enough to establish ourselves, much less a smooth organization, and our liberal base was dispirited after its candidate, Sissy Farenthold, lost a bruising primary battle for governor to Dolph Briscoe. For some reason, the highest-ranking state official who did support McGovern, Secretary of State Bob Bullock, wasn't even invited to meet him. McGovern wrote him an apology, but it was a telling oversight. Not long after McGovern left Texas, the campaign decided we needed some adult supervision, so they sent down a crusty, gray-haired Irishman from Sioux City, Iowa, Don O'Brien, who had been active in John Kennedy's campaign and had served as the U.S. attorney under Robert Kennedy. I liked Don O'Brien a lot, but he was an old-fashioned chauvinist who got on the nerves of a lot of our independent young women. Still, we made it work, and I was relieved because now I could spend even more time on the road. Those were my best days in Texas. I went north to Waco, where I met the liberal insurance magnate and future supporter of mine, Bernard Rappaport. East to Dallas, where I met Jess Hay, a moderate but loyal Democratic businessman who also stayed my friend and supporter. And a black state senator, Eddie Bernice Johnson, who became one of my strongest allies in Congress when I was elected president. Then to Houston, where I met and fell in love with the godmother of Texas liberals, Billy Carr, a big, raucous woman who reminded me a little of Mother. Billy took me under her wing and never let me go until the day she died, even when I disappointed her by being less liberal than she was. I had my first extensive contacts with Mexican Americans, commonly called Chicanos back then, and came to love their spirit, culture, and food. In San Antonio, I discovered Mario's and Mi Tierra, where I once ate 3 meals in 18 hours. I worked South Texas with Franklin Garcia, a tough labor organizer with a tender heart, and his friend Pat Robards. One night, Franklin and Pat drove Hillary and me over the Rio Grande to Matamoros, Mexico. They took us to a dive with a mariachi band, a half-hearted stripper, and a menu that featured cabrito, barbecued goat head. I was so exhausted, I fell asleep while the stripper was dancing and the goat head was looking up at me. One day, when I was driving alone in rural South Texas, I stopped at a filling station for gas and struck up a conversation with the young Mexican-American who was filling my tank and asked him to vote for McGovern. "I can't," he said. When I asked why, he replied, "Because of Eagleton. He should not have abandoned him. A lot of my people have troubles, but you have to stick with your friends." I never forgot his wise advice. When I was president, Hispanic Americans knew I had tried to be their friend, and they stuck with me. In the last week of the campaign, though all was lost, I had two memorable experiences. Congressman Henry B. Gonzalez hosted the Bexar County Democratic Dinner in San Antonio at the Minger Hotel near the Alamo, where more than 200 Texans under Jim Bowie and Davy Crockett died fighting for Texas's independence from Mexico. More than 60 years later, Teddy Roosevelt had stayed at the Minger while he was training the Rough Riders for their epic battle on San Juan Hill in Cuba. The Minger serves fantastic mango ice cream, to which I became addicted. On Election Eve 1992, when we stopped in San Antonio, my staff bought $400 worth of it, and everyone on the campaign plane ate it all night long. The speaker at the dinner was the House Majority Leader, Hale Boggs of Louisiana. He made an impassioned speech for McGovern and the Democrats. The next morning, I got him up early to catch a plane to Alaska, where he was scheduled to campaign with Congressman Nick Begich. The following day, on a swing through the snow-capped mountains, their plane crashed and was never found. I admired Hale Boggs and wished we had overslept that day. He left a remarkable family behind. His wife, Lindy, a lovely woman and a first-rate politician herself, took his New Orleans House seat and was one of my strongest supporters in Louisiana. I appointed her U.S. Ambassador to the Vatican. The other notable event occurred during Sergeant Shriver's last visit to Texas. We had a great rally in McAllen, deep in South Texas, and rushed back to the airport almost on time to fly to Texarkana, where Congressman Wright Patman had raised a crowd of several thousand people on State Line Boulevard, the border between Arkansas and Texas. For some reason, our plane didn't take off. After a few minutes, we learned that a pilot flying a single-engine plane had become disoriented in the foggy night sky above McAllen and was circling the airport, waiting to be talked down. In Spanish, first they had to find an instrument-rated pilot who could speak Spanish, then they had to calm the guy down and bring him in. As the drama unfolded, I was sitting across from Shriver briefing him on the Texarkana stop. If we had any doubt how low the campaign's fortunes had sunk, this removed it. Shriver took it all in stride and asked the flight attendants to serve dinner. Soon there were two planes full of staff and a large press corps eating steak on the tarmac in McAllen. When we finally got to Texarkana more than 3 hours late, the rally had disbanded. But about 200 diehards, including Congressman Patman, came to the airport to greet Shriver. He jumped off the plane and shook hands with every one of them as if it were the first day of a close election. McGovern lost Texas 67-33%, a slightly better showing than he made in Arkansas, where only 31% of the voters supported him. After the election, Taylor and I stayed around a few days to thank people and wrap things up. Then Hillary and I went back to Yale after a brief vacation in Zihuatanejo on Mexico's Pacific coast. It's built up now, but then it was still a little Mexican hamlet with bumpy, unpaved streets, open bars, and tropical birds in the trees. We got through our finals in good shape, especially considering our long absence. I had to work hard to master the arcane rules of admiralty law, which I took only because I wanted to have a course taught by Charles Black, an eloquent, courtly Texan who was well-liked and respected by the students and who was especially fond of Hillary. Much to my surprise, the jurisdiction of admiralty law extended to any waterway in the United States that had been navigable in its original condition. That included lakes built from damming once navigable rivers around my hometown. In the spring term of 1973, I took a full class load but was preoccupied with going home and with what was going to happen with Hillary. Both of us especially enjoyed staging that year's Barristers Union Prize trial. We wrote a trial based on the characters in the movie Casablanca. Ingrid Bergman's husband was killed, and Humphrey Bogart was put on trial for it. Burke Marshall's friend and former colleague in the Justice Department, John Doerr, came to New Haven with his young son to judge the trial. Hillary and I hosted him and were very impressed. It was easy to understand why he had been so effective in enforcing civil rights rulings in the South. He was quiet, direct, smart, and strong. He judged well, and Bogey was acquitted by the jury. One day after my class in corporate tax, Professor Chirlstein asked me what I was going to do when I graduated. I told him I was going home to Arkansas and supposed I would just hang up a shingle on my own since I had no job offers. He said there was a sudden, unexpected vacancy on the faculty of the University of Arkansas Law School at Fayetteville. He suggested that I apply for the position and volunteered to recommend me. It had never occurred to me that I could or should get a teaching job, but I was intrigued by the idea. A few days later, in late March, I drove home for Easter break. When I got to Little Rock, I pulled off the highway, went to a payphone, called the law school dean, Wiley Davis, introduced myself, told him what I'd heard about the vacancy, and said I'd like to apply. He said I was too young and inexperienced. I laughed and told him I'd been hearing that for years, but if he was hard up, I'd be good for him because I'd work hard and teach any courses he wanted. Besides, I wouldn't have tenure, so he could fire me at any time. He chuckled and invited me to Fayetteville for an interview. I flew there in the first week of May. I had strong letters of recommendation from Professor Cherylstein, Burke Marshall, Steve Duke, John Baker, and Caroline Deniger, chairman of the political science department at the University of New Haven, where I had taught constitutional law and criminal law to undergraduates. The interviews went well, and on May 12th, I got a letter from Dean Davis offering me a position as an assistant professor at a salary of $14,706. Hillary was all for it, and 10 days later, I accepted. It wasn't much money, but teaching would enable me to work off my National Defense Education loan rather than pay it off. My other law school loan was unique in that it required me and my classmates to pay our loans down with a small fixed percentage of our annual incomes until the aggregate debt of our class was retired. Obviously, those who made more paid more, but we all knew that when we borrowed the money. My experience with the Yale Loan Program was the stimulus for my desire to change the federal student loan program when I became president, so that students would have the option of repaying their loans over a longer period of time as a fixed percentage of their income. That way, they would be less likely to drop out of school for fear of not being able to repay their loans, and less reluctant to take jobs with high social utility but low pay. When we gave students the option of income contingent loans, a lot of them took it. Though I hadn't been the most diligent student, I was pleased with my law school years. I had learned a lot from some brilliant and dedicated professors and from my fellow students, more than 20 of whom I would later appoint to positions in the administration or the federal judiciary. I had come to a keener appreciation of the role the law plays in maintaining a sense of order and fairness in our society, and in providing a means to make social progress. Living in New Haven gave me a sense of the reality and ethnic diversity of urban America. And of course, it was in New Haven that I met Hillary. Thanks to the Duffy and McGovern campaigns, I had made some good friends who shared my passion for politics and learned more about the mechanics of electioneering. I had also learned again that winning elections as a progressive requires great care and discipline in crafting and presenting a message and a program that gives people the confidence to change course. Our society can absorb only so much change at a time, and when we move forward, we must do it in a way that reaffirms our core convictions of opportunity and responsibility, work and family, strength and compassion, the values that have been the bedrock of America's success. Most people have their hands full raising their kids, doing their jobs, and paying bills. They don't think about government policy as much as liberals do, nor are they as obsessed with power as the new right conservatives. They have a lot of common sense and a desire to understand the larger forces shaping their lives, but can't be expected to abandon the values and social arrangements that at least enable them to survive and feel good about themselves. Since 1968, conservatives have been very good at convincing middle America that progressive candidates, ideas, and policies are alien to their values and threatening to their security. Joe Duffy was a coal miner's son who was morphed into a weak, ultra-liberal elitist. George McGovern was a genuine war hero sent to the Senate by the conservatives of rural South Dakota, who was turned into a spineless, wild-eyed leftist who wouldn't stand up for America, but would tax and spend it into oblivion. In both cases, the candidates and their campaigns made mistakes that reinforced the images their opponents were trying hard to create. I already knew enough about how difficult it was to push the rocks of civil rights, peace, and anti-poverty programs up the political hill to know we couldn't expect to win all the time. But I was determined to stop helping our opponents win without a fight. Later, both as governor and as president, I made some of the same mistakes all over again, but not as many as I would have had I not been given the chance to work for those two good men, Joe Duffy and George McGovern. I was happy to be going home to the prospect of interesting work, but I still didn't know what to do about Hillary or what was best for her. I had always believed that she had as much or more potential to succeed in politics as I did, and I wanted her to have her chance. Back then, I wanted it for her more than she did, and I thought that coming to Arkansas with me would end the prospect of a political career for her. I didn't want to do that, but I didn't want to give her up either. Hillary had already decided against working for a big firm or clerking for a judge in favor of a position with Marion Edelman's Children's Defense Fund in its new office in Cambridge, Massachusetts, so we were going to be a long way away from each other. That was all we knew when we finished law school and I took Hillary on her first overseas trip. I gave her a tour of London and Oxford, then we went west to Wales, then back into England to the Lake District, which I hadn't seen before. It's beautiful and romantic there in the late spring. One evening at sunset on the shore of Lake Ennerdale, I asked Hillary to marry me. I couldn't believe I'd done it. Neither could she. She said she loved me, but couldn't say yes. I couldn't blame her, but I didn't want to lose her. So I asked her to come home to Arkansas with me to see how she liked it, and to take the Arkansas bar exam, just in case. Chapter 18. In June, Hillary flew to Little Rock for a visit. I took her home the long way to show her a part of the state I loved. We drove west up the Arkansas River for 70 miles to Russellville, then south down Highway 7 through the Ouachita Mountains and National Forest, stopping from time to time to look at the beautiful vistas. We spent a couple of days in Hot Springs with Mother, Jeff, and Roger, then went back to Little Rock for a prep course on the Arkansas bar exam, which proved helpful enough that both of us passed. After the bar, Hillary went back to Massachusetts to start her job with the Children's Defense Fund, and I went to Fayetteville to begin my new life as a law professor. I found the perfect place to live, a beautiful little house designed by the famous Arkansas architect Fay Jones, whose stunning thorn-crowned chapel in nearby Eureka Springs won international awards and accolades. The house was on more than 80 acres of land, about 8 miles east of Fayetteville, on Highway 16. The land's eastern border was the middle fork of the White River. A few dozen cattle grazed the pasture. The house, built in the mid-1950s, was essentially a one-room structure, long and thin, divided down the middle with the bathroom dropped like a block in the center. Both the front and back walls were a series of sliding glass doors, which along with skylights in the bedroom and bathroom guaranteed lots of light. Running in front of the whole length of the living room was a screened-in porch, which jutted out from the house as the land sloped down to the road. The house proved to be a godsend of peace and quiet, especially after I started my first campaign. I loved to sit on the porch and near the fireplace and to walk in the field by the river with the cattle. The house did have a couple of drawbacks. Mice visited every night. When I realized I couldn't get rid of them and they kept to themselves in the kitchen, I started leaving them breadcrumbs. The outdoors was full of spiders, ticks, and other menaces. They didn't bother me much, but when a brown recluse spider bit Hillary, her leg swelled up enormously and took a long time to go back down, and the place was impossible to secure. We had a rash of burglaries across northwest Arkansas that summer. The culprit was hitting lots of rural houses up and down Highway 16. One evening when I came home, it looked as if someone had been there, but nothing was missing. Perhaps I'd scared him off. On impulse, I sat down and wrote a letter to the burglar in case he came back. Dear burglar, things in my house were so much the same, I could not tell whether or not you actually entered the house yesterday. If not, here is what you will find. A TV which cost $80 new 1.5 years ago. A radio which cost $40 new 3 years ago. A tiny record player that cost $40 new 3 years ago. And a lot of keepsakes. Little things, very few of which cost over $10. Almost all the clothes are over 2 or 3 years old. Hardly worth risking jail for. William J. Clinton. I taped the letter to the fireplace. Unfortunately, the ploy didn't work. The next day when I was at work, the guy came back and took the TV, the radio, the record player, and one thing I purposefully left off the list, a beautifully engraved German military sword from World War I. I was heartsick about losing it because Daddy had given it to me and because just a year earlier, the only other valuable thing I owned, the Selmer Mark VI tenor saxophone Mother and Daddy had given me in 1963, had been stolen out of my car in Washington. Eventually, I replaced the sax with a 1935 Selmer cigar cutter model, but the sword proved irreplaceable. I spent the last weeks of a very hot August preparing my classes and running around the university track in the hottest hours of the day, getting my weight down to 185 pounds for the first and last time since I was 13. In September, I began to teach my first classes, antitrust, which I had studied at Yale and enjoyed very much, and agency and partnership, dealing with the nature of contractual relationships and the legal responsibilities that arise out of them. I had 16 students in antitrust and 56 in A&P. Antitrust law is rooted in the idea that the government should prevent the formation of monopolies as well as other non-competitive practices in order to preserve a functioning, fair, free market economy. Since I knew that not all the students had a good grounding in economics, I tried hard to make the material clear and the principles understandable. Agency and partnership, by contrast, seemed straightforward enough. I was afraid the students would get bored and also miss the importance and occasional difficulty of determining the exact nature of the relationships between parties in a common enterprise, so I tried to think of interesting and illuminating examples to keep the classroom discussion going. For example, the Watergate hearings and the White House response to the ongoing revelations had raised a lot of questions about the perpetrators of the break-in. Were they agents of the president, and if not, for whom and on whose authority were they acting? In all the classes I taught, I tried to get a lot of students involved in the discussions and to make myself easily available to them in my office and around the law school. I enjoyed writing exams, which I hoped would be interesting, challenging, and fair. In the accounts I've read of my teaching years, my grading has been questioned, with the implication that I was too easy, either because I was too soft or too eager not to offend potential supporters when I ran for office. At Yale, the only grades were honors, pass, or fail. It was usually pretty hard to get honors and virtually impossible to fail. At many other law schools, especially those where the admission standards were more lax, the grading tended to be tougher, with the expectation that 20% to 30% of a class should fail. I didn't agree with that. If a student got a bad grade, I always felt like a failure too, for not having engaged his or her interest or effort. Almost all the students were intellectually capable of learning enough to get a C. On the other hand, I thought a good grade should mean something. In my big classes ranging from 50 to 90 students, I gave 2 or 3 A's and about the same number of D's. In one class of 77, I gave only 1 A, and only once did I flunk a student. Usually the students who were going to flunk would withdraw rather than risk an F. In 2 smaller classes, I gave more A's because the students worked harder, learned more, and deserved them. Although the University of Arkansas Law School's first black students had entered 25 years earlier, It was not until the early 70s that a substantial number of them finally began to enter state law schools across the South. Many were not well prepared, especially those whose education had been confined to poor, segregated schools. About 20 black students took my courses between 1973 and 1976, and I got to know the others. Almost all of them were working very hard. They wanted to succeed, and several of them lived under enormous emotional pressure because they were afraid they couldn't make it. Sometimes their fears were justified. I'll never forget reading one black student's exam paper with a mixture of disbelief and anger. I knew he had studied like a demon and understood the material, but his exam didn't show it. The right answers were in there, but finding them required digging through piles of misspelled words, bad grammar, and poor sentence construction. An A's worth of knowledge was hidden in the bushes of an F presentation, flawed by things he hadn't learned going all the way back to elementary school. I gave him a B-, corrected the grammar and spelling, and decided to set up tutoring sessions to help transform the black student's hard work and native intelligence into better results. I think they helped both substantively and psychologically, though several of the students continued to struggle with their writing skills and with the emotional burden of having one foot through the door of opportunity and the other held back by the heavy weight of past segregation. When many of those students went on to distinguished careers as lawyers and judges, the clients they represented and the parties they judged probably had no idea how high a mountain they had had to climb to reach the bar or the bench. When the Supreme Court upheld the principle of affirmative action in 2003, I thought of my black students, of how hard they worked and all they had to overcome. They gave me all the evidence I'd ever need to support the court's ruling. Besides my interaction with the students, the best thing about being a law professor was being part of a faculty filled with people I liked and admired. My best friends on the faculty were two people my age, Elizabeth Osenbaugh and Dick Atkinson. Elizabeth was a brilliant Iowa farm girl, a good Democrat, and a devoted teacher who became good friends with Hillary, too. Eventually, she went back to Iowa to work in the Attorney General's office. When I was elected president, I persuaded her to come to the Justice Department, but after a few years she again went back home, largely because she thought it would be better for her young daughter, Betsy. Sadly, Elizabeth died of cancer in 1998, and her daughter went to live with Elizabeth's brother. I have tried to keep in touch with Betsy over the years. Her mother was one of the finest people I've ever known. Dick Atkinson was a friend from law school who had grown dissatisfied with private practice in Atlanta. I suggested he consider teaching and urged him to come to Fayetteville for an interview. He did and was offered and accepted a position on our faculty. The students loved Dick and he loved teaching. In 2003, he would become dean of the Arkansas Law School. Our most famous and fascinating professor was Robert Loeffler, the most eminent legal scholar our state ever produced, a recognized authority in torts, conflicts of law, and appellate judging. In 1973, he was already past the mandatory retirement age of 70 and was teaching a full load for $1 a year. He had been on the faculty since he was 26. For several years before I knew him, Bob had commuted weekly between Fayetteville and New York, where he taught a course in appellate judging to federal and state judges at New York University Law School, a course that more than half the Supreme Court justices had taken. He was never late for class in either place. Bob Loeffler was a small, wiry man with huge, piercing eyes, and he was still as strong as an ox. He couldn't have weighed more than 150 pounds, but while working in his yard, he carried around big chunks of flagstone that I could hardly lift. After every Razorback football homecoming game, Bob and his wife Helen hosted a party in their home. Sometimes guests would play touch football in the front yard. I remember one game in particular, when Bob and I and another young lawyer played against two big young guys and a 9-year-old boy. The game was tied, and we all agreed that whoever scored next would win. Our side had the ball. I asked Bob if he really wanted to win. He said, "I sure do." He was as competitive as Michael Jordan. So I told the third man on our team to center the ball, let the rusher come after me, and go block the tall man defending the backfield to the right. The 9-year-old was covering Bob on the assumption that I'd throw the ball to the taller, younger man, or that if Bob got the ball, the kid would be able to touch him. I told Bob to block the kid to the right, too, then run hard left, and I'd throw the ball to him right before the rusher got to me. When the ball was snapped, Bob was so excited he knocked the boy to the ground and ran left. He was wide open when our teammate completed his blocking assignment. I lobbed the ball to Bob, and he ran across the goal line, the happiest 75-year-old man in America. Bob Loeffler had a steel-trap mind, the heart of a lion, a tough will, and a childlike love of life. He was sort of a democratic version of Strom Thurmond. If we had more like him, we'd win more often. When Bob died at 93, I thought he was still too young to go. Law school policies were set by the faculty at regular meetings. On occasion, I thought they ran too long and got too mired in details best left to the dean and other administrators. But I learned a lot about academic governance and politics in them. Generally, I deferred to my colleagues when there was a consensus because I felt they knew more than I did and had a longer-term commitment to the academic life. I did urge the faculty to undertake more pro bono activities and to relax the publish or perish imperative for professors in favor of greater emphasis on classroom teaching and spending more out-of-class time with students. My own pro bono work included handling minor legal problems for students and a young assistant professor, trying unsuccessfully to persuade more doctors in Springdale, just north of Fayetteville, to accept poor patients on Medicaid, preparing a brief for the U.S. Supreme Court in an antitrust case at the request of Attorney General Jim Guy Tucker, and, in my first appearance as a lawyer in court, filing a brief to defend my friend State Representative Steve Smith in an election law dispute in Madison County. Huntsville, the county seat and Orbel Faubus's hometown, had a little more than 1,000 people. The Democrats held all the courthouse offices from the judge and sheriff on down, but there were a lot of Republicans in the hills and hollows of North Arkansas, most of them descendants of people who had opposed secession in 1861. The Republicans had made a good showing in 1972, aided by the Nixon landslide, and they felt that if they could get enough absentee ballots thrown out, they might reverse the results of the local elections. The case was tried in the old Madison County Courthouse before Judge Bill Enfield, a Democrat who later became a friend and supporter of mine. The Democrats were represented by two real characters, Bill Murphy, a Fayetteville lawyer whose great passions were the American Legion, which he served as Arkansas commander, and the Democratic Party, and a local lawyer, W.Q. Hall, known as Q, a one-armed wit with a sense of humor as sharp as the hook affixed to his left arm. The people hauled in to testify about why they voted absentee offered a vivid picture of the fierce loyalties, rough politics, and economic pressures that shaped the lives of Arkansas Hill people. One man had to defend voting absentee at the last minute without having applied in advance as the law required. He explained that he worked for the State Game and Fish Commission, and he went down to vote on the day before the election because he had just been ordered to take the state's only bear trap over slow mountain roads to Stone County on election day. His vote was allowed. Another man was called back from his job in Tulsa, Oklahoma, to testify. He admitted that he had lived in Tulsa for more than 10 years, but still voted by absentee ballot in Madison County in every election, though he was no longer a legal resident there. When the Republican lawyer pressed him on it, he said with great emotion that Madison County was his home, that he had gone to Tulsa only because he couldn't make a living in the hills, and that he didn't know or care anything about politics there. and that in another 10 years or so, as soon as he could retire, he was coming home. I can't remember whether his vote was counted, but his attachment to his roots left a lasting impression on me. Steve Smith testified about his role in gathering absentee ballots from the residents in his father's nursing home. The law seemed to allow people associated with nursing homes to help residents fill out their ballots, but required the ballots to be mailed by a family member or someone with specific written authorization to do so. Steve had picked up all the ballots and dropped them in the nearest mailbox. I presented the judge with what I thought was a very persuasive brief, arguing that it was nonsensical to say Steve couldn't mail them. No one has suggested that he had tampered with them or that the residents didn't want him to mail them. For all we knew, not all the elderly residents even had family members who could perform the chore. Judge Enfield ruled against me and Steve, but upheld enough of the absentee votes for County Judge Charles Wharton, Sheriff Ralph Baker, and their crew to stay in office.
End of Disc 9. Disc 10.
Judge Enfield ruled against me and Steve, but upheld enough of the absentee votes for County Judge Charles Wharton, Sheriff Ralph Baker, and their crew to stay in office. I had lost my part of the case, but gained invaluable insight into the lives of Arkansas Hill people, and I had made friends with some of the most effective politicians I would ever know. If a new person moved into Madison County, they would know within a week if he or she was a Democrat or a Republican. The Republicans had to come to the courthouse to register to vote. The county clerk went to the Democrats' homes to register them. 2 weeks before each election, they called all the Democrats asking for their votes. They were called again on election morning. If they hadn't voted by late afternoon, someone went to their homes and took them to the polls. On the day of my first general election in 1974, I called Charles Wharton to see how we were doing. He said heavy rain had washed a bridge out in a remote part of the county, and some of our folks couldn't get to the polls, but they were working hard and thought we would win by about 500 votes. I carried Madison County by 501 votes. A couple of months after I moved to Fayetteville, I felt completely at home there. I loved teaching, going to Razorbacks football games, driving around in the mountains, and living in a university community of people who cared about the things I did. I made friends with Carl Willock, a university vice president who had short gray hair and a very reserved manner. I first met him at lunch at Wyatt's Cafeteria in the big shopping mall on a hill between Fayetteville and Springdale. Everyone at our table was criticizing President Nixon except Carl, who didn't say a word. I had no idea what he thought, so I asked him. I'll never forget his monotone reply. I agree with Harry Truman. He said Richard Nixon is the kind of man who would take wooden nickels off a dead man's eyes. In the old days, wooden nickels were the round wood objects morticians put on the eyes of corpses to keep them closed during the embalming process. Carl Willock was a book you couldn't judge by its cover. Beneath his button-down appearance was a tough mind and a brave heart. I especially liked two women professors whose husbands were in the state legislature. Anne Henry taught at the business school. Her husband, Morris, was an ophthalmologist and our state senator. Ann and Morris became special friends to Hillary and me, and when we married, they hosted our wedding reception at their home. Diane Kincaid was a professor in the political science department, then married to State Representative Hugh Kincaid. Diane was beautiful, brilliant, and politically savvy. When Hillary moved to Fayetteville, Diane and Hillary became more than friends. They were soulmates, finding in each other's company the kind of understanding, stimulation, support, and love that come along all too rarely in life. Though Fayetteville, like all of northwest Arkansas, was growing fast, it still had a quaint little town square and an old post office in the middle, which was later converted into a restaurant and bar. Retail stores, offices, and banks lined the four sides of the square, and every Saturday morning it was filled with a farmer's market offering fresh produce. My cousin Roy Clinton ran the Campbell Bell department store on the northwest corner of the square. I traded with him and learned a lot about my new hometown. The courthouse was just a block off the square. The local lawyers who practiced there and had offices nearby included an impressive collection of wily older lawyers and bright young ones, many of whom would soon become strong supporters. The local political hangout was Billy Schneider's Steakhouse on Highway 71 north of town. Billy was a hard-boiled, gravel-voiced, tough-talking woman who had seen it all but never lost her consuming, idealistic passion for politics. All the local politicos hung out at her place, including Don Tyson, the chicken magnate whose operation would become the largest agricultural company in the world, and Don's lawyer, Jim Blair, a 6-foot-5-inch idiosyncratic genius who would become one of my closest friends. A few months after I moved to Fayetteville, Billy closed the steakhouse and opened a bar and disco in the basement of a hotel across the street from the courthouse. All the same folks hung out there, but she also developed a big following among university students, whom she mobilized to work for her candidates in elections. Billy was a big part of my life until the day we buried her. I left my mountain lair for a few days over Thanksgiving to visit Hillary in Cambridge. She and I didn't resolve our situation, but she did agree to come visit me over the Christmas holidays. I loved her and wanted to be with her, but I understood her reservations. I was passionate and driven, and nothing in my background indicated I knew what a stable marriage was all about. She knew that being married to me would be a high-wire operation in more ways than one. Also, Arkansas must still have seemed an alien place for her to settle, though she no longer felt it was the other side of the moon. And as I've said, I wasn't sure it was right for her. I still thought she should have her own political career. At that point in my life, I thought that work was more important than having a personal life. I had met many of the ablest people of my generation, and I thought that she was head and shoulders above them all in political potential. She had a big brain, a good heart, better organizational skills than I did, and political skills that were nearly as good as mine. I just had more experience. I loved her enough both to want her and to want the best for her. It was a high-class dilemma. When I got back to Arkansas, political talk had begun in earnest. Like Democrats everywhere, our people were stirred up by Senator Sam Ervin's Watergate hearings and the continuation of the war. It appeared we would have a chance to make some gains in the midterm congressional elections, especially after the price of oil shot up and gasoline began to be rationed. However, the local Democrats did not believe the prospects of unseating our Congressman John Paul Hammerschmidt were very good. Hammerschmidt had a very conservative voting record and was a strong defender of President Nixon. But he also had a friendly, low-key manner, came home and traveled his district on most weekends, and had a fabulous casework operation, helping little towns get water and sewer grants and securing government benefits for constituents, often from programs he had voted to slash back in Washington. Hammerschmidt was in the lumber business, had good support from the small business people in the district, and took care of the large timber, poultry, and trucking interests, which made up a significant portion of the economy. I talked to several people that fall about whether they would be interested in running, including Hugh and Diane Kincaid, Morris and Ann Henry, Steve Smith, and State Representative Rudy Moore, who was Clark Willock's brother-in-law. Everyone thought the race needed to be made, but no one wanted to make it. It seemed too unwinnable. Also, it seemed that Governor Bumpers, who was immensely popular, was likely to challenge Senator Fulbright in the Democratic primary. Fulbright was from Fayetteville, and most of my friends, though they liked Bumpers, felt obligated to help the senator in what was sure to be an all-uphill battle. As it became clear that no one in our area who could run a strong race was willing to do it, I began to think about running myself. It seemed absurd on the face of it. I had been home only 6 months after 9 years away. I was just 3 months into my new job. I had no contacts in most of the district. On the other hand, Fayetteville, with its students and liberal Democrats, was not a bad place to start. Hot Springs, where I grew up, was the biggest town in the south end of the district, and Yale County, where the Clintons were from, was part of it, too. All told, I had relatives in 5 of the district's 21 counties. I was young, single, and willing to work all hours of the day and night. And even if I didn't win, if I made a good showing, I didn't think it would hurt me in any future campaigns I might undertake. Of course, if I got waxed, my long-hoped-for political career could be over before it began. I had a lot to think about when Hillary came to visit me shortly after Christmas. We were talking it over in my house one morning in early January when the phone rang. It was John Doerr, with whom Hillary and I had spent some time the previous spring when he came to Yale to judge our Casablanca Prize trial. He told me that he had just agreed to become the chief counsel for the House Judiciary Committee's inquiry into whether President Nixon should be impeached, and that Burke Marshall had recommended me to him. He wanted me to take a leave of absence from the law school, come to work, and help him recruit some other good young lawyers. I told him I was thinking about running for Congress, but I'd consider the offer and call him back the next day. I had to think fast, and as would so often happen in the years ahead, I turned to Hillary for judgment and advice. By the time I called John back, I had made up my mind. I thanked him for the offer but declined, saying that I had decided to make the long-shot race for Congress instead, because there were lots of gifted young lawyers who would give anything to work for him on the impeachment inquiry, but no one else to take on the fight in Arkansas. I could tell John thought I was making a foolish mistake, and by every rational standard I was. But as I've said before, a lot of your life is shaped by the opportunities you turn down as much as those you take up. I suggested to John that he ought to sign up Hillary and our Yale classmates Mike Conway and Rufus Cormier. He laughed and said Burke Marshall had recommended them too. Eventually, they all went to work for John and did an outstanding job. Doerr wound up with an extraordinary array of talented young people, proving that, as I expected, he didn't need me to have a great staff. A couple of days before Hillary had to go back to Cambridge, I took her to Huntsville, about 25 miles east of my house, to see former Governor Faubus. If I was going to run for Congress, I'd have to pay a courtesy call on him sooner or later. Besides, much as I disapproved of what he had done at Little Rock, he was bright and had a brain full of Arkansas political lore, which I wanted to pick. Faubus lived in a beautiful Big Fay Jones house his supporters had built for him when after 12 years he left the governor's office with no money. He was then living with his second wife, Elizabeth, an attractive Massachusetts woman who still wore a 1960s beehive hairdo and who, before her marriage, had had a brief career as a political commentator in Little Rock. She was extremely conservative, and was in stark contrast in both looks and outlook to the governor's first wife, Alta, who was a good hill country populist and the editor of the local paper, the Madison County Record. Hillary and I were ushered into the Faubus home and seated at a big round table in an all-glass alcove looking out on the Ozarks and the town below. For the next 4 or 5 hours, I asked questions and Orville talked, delivering a fascinating account of Arkansas history and politics, what life was like during the Depression and World War II, why he was still defending what he had done in Little Rock, and how he thought President Nixon's problems might or might not affect the congressional race. I didn't say much. I would just ask a new question when Faubus finished answering the previous one. Hillary didn't say anything. Surprisingly, for more than 4 hours, Elizabeth Faubus didn't either. She just kept us supplied with coffee and cookies. Finally, when it was obvious the interview was winding down, Elizabeth Faubus stared hard at me and said, "This is all very well, Mr. Clinton, But how do you feel about the international conspiracy to overthrow the United States? I stared right back and replied, Why, I'm against it, Mrs. Faubus, aren't you? Not long afterward, the Faubuses moved to Houston, where Orville was distraught after Elizabeth was brutally murdered in their apartment. When I was inaugurated governor in 1979, I invited all the former governors to attend, including Faubus. It was a controversial move among my progressive supporters who felt I'd given the old rascal new life. The way it played out proved them right, a classic example of the old adage that no good deed goes unpunished. Still, I'd do it all over again just to have the Red Menace exchange with Elizabeth Faubus. After Hillary left, I went to see Dean Davis and told him I wanted to run for Congress and promised to keep up with all my classwork and to make time for the students. I was assigned to teach criminal procedure and admiralty in the spring term and had already done quite a bit of the preparation work. To my surprise, Wiley gave me his blessing, probably because it was too late to get anyone else to teach the courses. Arkansas's 3rd District comprised 21 counties in the northwest quadrant of the state and was one of America's most rural congressional districts. It included the big counties of Washington and Benton in the extreme northwest, 7 northern counties in the Ozarks, 8 counties in the Arkansas River Valley below, and 4 in the Ouachita Mountains in the southwest. Thanks to Walmart, Tyson Foods, and other poultry companies, and trucking companies like J.B. Hunt, Willis Shaw, and Harvey Jones, the towns in Benton and Washington counties were growing more prosperous and more Republican. Eventually, the growth of evangelical Christian churches and the influx of retirees from the Midwest combined with the success of the big companies to make Northwest Arkansas the most Republican and most conservative part of the state, with the exception of Fayetteville, where the university kept things in closer balance. In 1974, Fort Smith, on the Oklahoma border, was both the district's biggest city with a population of 72,286 and its most conservative. In the 1960s, the city fathers had turned down urban renewal funds, which they believed were the first step to socialism. And when Watergate figure John Mitchell was indicted a few years later, his lawyer said Fort Smith was one of only 3 places in America where he could get a fair trial. What he would have gotten there was a hero's welcome. East of Fort Smith, down the Arkansas River, and in the mountains to the north, the counties tended to be populist, socially conservative, and pretty evenly divided between Republicans and Democrats. The mountain counties, especially Madison, Newton, and Searcy, were still fairly isolated. A few new people moved in, but many families had been on the same land for more than 100 years. They spoke in a unique way, using vivid expressions I had never heard before. My favorite was a description of someone you really don't like. "I wouldn't piss in his ear if his brain was on fire." The rural counties in the southern part of the district tended to be more Democratic, but still conservative, and the largest county, Garland, with Hot Springs as the county seat, usually voted Republican in presidential elections and had a lot of new Republican retirees from up north. The congressman was very popular there. There were very few blacks, most of them concentrated in Fort Smith, Hot Springs, the district's 2nd largest city, and in the river valley towns of Russellville and Dardanelle in the southeast part of the district. Organized labor had a fairly strong presence in Fayetteville, Fort Smith, and Hot Springs, but not much elsewhere. Because of bad mountain roads and the predominance of old cars and pickups, the district had the highest gasoline usage per registered vehicle of any in the United States, a factor of no small importance given the rising price and shortage of gas. It also had the highest percentage of disabled veterans of any congressional district. Congressman Hammerschmidt was a World War II veteran who courted veterans heavily. In the previous election, the social and fiscal conservative forces had overwhelmed the hardcore Democrats and economic populists, as Nixon defeated McGovern 74-26%. Hammerschmidt got 77%. No wonder no one else wanted to make the race. A few days after Hillary left, Carl Willock took me on my first campaign trip, a swing across the district's northern counties. We stopped first in Carroll County. In Berryville, a town of about 1,300, I visited the store of Cy Bigham, a prominent local Democrat who had his 4-year-old grandson with him. More than 20 years later, that little boy, Chris Angscough, would become my personal aide in the White House. I also met the local Methodist minister, Vic Nixon, and his wife, Freddie. They were liberal Democrats who opposed the Vietnam War, and they agreed to support me. They wound up doing far more. Freddie became my county coordinator, charmed the socks off the leaders in all the rural voting precincts, and later worked for me in the governor's office, where she never stopped trying to convince me that the death penalty was wrong. When Hillary and I got married, Vic performed the ceremony. We drove on east to Boone County and then drove to Mountain Home, county seat of the district's northeasternmost county, Baxter. Carl wanted me to meet Hugh Hackler, a businessman who told us right off the bat that he was committed to another candidate in the primary. Still, we started talking. When he found out I was from Hot Springs, he told me Gabe Crawford was a good friend of his. When I replied that Gabe had been Daddy's best friend, Hugh got out of his commitment to the other guy and supported me. I also met Veda Sheed, who owned a furniture store and was the county treasurer. She noticed a loose button on my shirt and sewed it on while we visited. She became a supporter that day, too. She never sewed another button for me, but after I became governor and she went to the state senate, her votes often bailed me out in other ways. After we left Mountain Home, we drove south to Searcy County. We stopped in St. Joe, which had about 150 people, to see the county Democratic chairman, Will Goggins. Will was over 80, but still sharp as a tack, physically strong, and passionate about his politics. When he said he'd be for me, I knew it meant a lot of votes, as you'll see. In the county seat of Marshall, I met George Daniel, who ran the local hardware store. George's younger brother, James, was a student at the law school who gave me one of my first $1,000 contributions. His older brother, Charles, was the county's doctor. I got a lot of laughs out of George's homespun humor and learned one searing lesson. A Vietnam veteran who had been away from the county for several years came into his store one day and bought a pistol. He said he wanted to do some target practice. A day later, he killed 6 people. It turned out he had just walked away from Fort Roots, the federal mental health facility for veterans in North Little Rock, where he'd been for several years, apparently because of trauma from his war experiences. It took George Daniel a long time to get over that, and it was the best argument I ever encountered for the kind of background checks on gun buyers required by the Brady Bill, which I finally signed into law in 1993 after 19 more years of avoidable killings by known felons, stalkers, and people with mental disorders. When Carl and I got back to Fayetteville, I was higher than a kite. I had always liked one-on-one retail politics when I was working for other candidates. Now I really loved going into the little towns or stopping at country stores, cafes, and filling stations along the road. I was never very good at asking for money, but I liked going into people's homes and businesses and asking for their votes. Besides, you could never tell when you would meet a colorful character, hear an interesting story, learn something worth knowing, or make a new friend. That first day on the campaign trail would be followed by scores of others just like it. I would set out in the morning from Fayetteville, work as many towns and counties as I could until late at night, then head back home if I had to teach the next day, or if I didn't, stay with a hospitable Democrat so I could go on to the next county in the morning. The next Sunday I went back east to finish up the mountain counties. I almost didn't make it. I had forgotten to fill the tank of my 1970 American Motors Gremlin before the weekend. Because of the gasoline shortage, federal law required filling stations to be closed on Sunday. But I had to get back to the hills. In desperation, I called the president of our local natural gas company, Charles Sharlaw, and asked him if he would let me have a tank of gas from the pump in his equipment yard. He told me to go on down there and he'd take care of it. To my astonishment, he showed up and filled my gas tank himself. Charles Charlow single-handedly kept my fledgling campaign going. First, I drove to Alpena to see the county Democratic chairman, Beau Forney, whom I had missed on my first stop there. I found his little house with no trouble. There was a pickup truck with a gun rack in the front yard, standard equipment for mountain men. Beau met me at the front door in jeans and a white T-shirt over his ample girth. He was watching TV and didn't say much as I made my pitch for his support. When I finished, he said that Hammerschmidt needed beating, and that although he would win his hometown of Harrison by a large margin, he thought we could do some good in the rural part of Boone County. Then he gave me the names of some people to see, told me I'd get more votes if I got a haircut, said he'd support me, and went back to his television. I wasn't sure what to make of Beau until I took a closer look at his pickup on my way back to the car. It had a bumper sticker that said, "Don't blame me, I voted for McGovern." Later, when I asked Beau about the bumper sticker, he said he didn't care what the critics said about McGovern. The Democrats were for the common people, and the Republicans weren't, and that's all there was to it. When I was president and Beau was in ill health, our mutual friend and fellow Yellow Dog Democrat, Levi Phillips, brought him to spend the night with us in the White House. Beau had a good time, but refused to sleep in the Lincoln bedroom. He couldn't forgive him for the Republican Party's excesses during the Reconstruction era after the Civil War, or for its devotion to the wealthy and powerful throughout the 20th century. Now that Beau and Mr. Lincoln are both in heaven, I like to think they've gotten together and resolved their differences.